This is a podcast from WILL AM 580. To support our station, please visit www.willpledge.org. That's www.willpledge.org.
This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast for Thursday, October 18th. I'm Tom Rogers. Coming up, the next installment in a series called The DNA Files, talking about who actually owns our DNA. We'll also get a forecast, possibly some severe weather today. We'll hear the latest with AM 580 meteorologist Scott Olthoff first to look at today's news. The next leader of the University of Illinois Police Training Institute is the University Police Department's interim chief. Crystal Fitzpatrick will take over the top post at the Institute November 16th if the Board of Trustees approves. Fitzpatrick would replace Tom Dempsey, who resigned last month under fire for a deal that he signed between the U of I and the security company Blackwater USA. Dempsey later worked for Blackwater, and the contract has since been canceled. University spokeswoman Robin Kaler says a search committee didn't have to look far for Dempsey's replacement.
She has very deep knowledge of the university. She's very well respected among the law enforcement community in the area, and she has earned the trust of university administration over her years at the institution.
Fitzpatrick has been the interim U of I police chief on the Urbana campus since late last year, while the university conducts a national search for a permanent chief. The Police Training Institute operates classes for more than 850 Illinois police and corrections officers each year. Complaints of political bias in college classrooms across the country are generating discussions on the University of Illinois campus. But two professors believe that anecdotal reports of instructors injecting their political beliefs into lectures and assignments don't represent the larger picture. Speaking on yesterday's Focus 580 program, law professor Matthew Finken said political discussion can be a productive part of classroom discussion without becoming indoctrination.
The question is what references advance the purpose of the class and what don't. And I agree that students today, you can't fool them. They know when they're being flim-flammed. The brouhaha that's been stimulated seems to me to be really much of a tempest in a teapot.
Political science professor Brian Gaines says an instructor who brings personal political views into the classroom is often counterproductive since they may bog down discussion about the curriculum. Both Gaines and Finken say making a certain political view a prerequisite for getting a good grade in class is prohibited, but both also say there are situations that have generated controversy and they're usually corrected. U of I students, faculty, and the public will get a chance to discuss the issue of academic political bias in a forum next week, next Tuesday, at Gregory Hall. Teachers and other employers in the Monticello School District finally have a new contract. The Unit 25 School Board voted last night unanimously to ratify the agreement. Members of the Monticello Education Association did the same 2 weeks ago. In a news release, Superintendent Vic Zimmerman says the new contract includes 5.5% annual raises for certified staff and raises of 4.5% for non-certified staff each year. Monticello school employees had been without a contract since July 1st. As he's done every other year since he became governor, Rob Blagojevich got an extension on his taxes. Now that he's filed his returns, Amanda Vinicky takes a look at what they show.
The Blagojeviches made just over $267,000 last year. That includes the governor's $150,000 annual salary, as well as $100,000 from the real estate firm the governor's wife, Patty, owns. A spokeswoman confirms that the First Lady made an unknown portion of those wages by working as a real estate broker for the Mahajan family, who's given heavily to the governor's campaign fund. Anita Mahajan is under indictment for stealing millions from taxpayers. Her company had a no-bid state contract to conduct drug tests. Mahajan billed the state, but allegedly failed to perform the tests. Prosecutors say Mahajan used some of that state money to purchase new properties and employed Patty Blagojevich as her broker. The Blagojeviches deducted nearly $4,000 worth of charitable contributions, which amounts to 1.5% of their income. I'm Amanda Vinicky.
Turnout was light at a public meeting last night in Urbana for homeowners who face possible foreclosures on their mortgages. But as AM 580's Jim Meadows reports, organizers say they'll continue their efforts to help people stay in their homes.
Phil Edwards of Champaign says it took the help of housing counselors at the Metanoia Centers to prevent the holder of his mortgage from foreclosing on his home.
When we started running into problems, as long as my wife was working, everything was okay. You know, it was one of those fair weather type relationships with our mortgage company. Once we fell on hard times, that's when it started becoming, they were more hard to get in touch with and things became a lot more difficult, and that's where Metanoia came in to help.
Edward says Metanoia was able to negotiate new arrangements with his lender that allowed he and his wife to keep their home. Metanoia Executive Director, the Reverend Eugene Barnes, says there are many more people facing foreclosure in Champaign-Urbana. He blames that on the jump in subprime mortgages and such practices as adjustable mortgage rates. Metanoia and the Central Illinois Organizing Project held last night's meeting at St. Patrick's Church to educate homeowners about their mortgage options and to organize efforts to pressure more lenders to work with housing counselors. While fewer than 20 people turned out, organizers say they'll continue their efforts. I'm Jim Meadows, AM 580 News.
An internationally known security expert says serious questions remain about the susceptibility of our own nation's power grid. Sami Sajjari is the founder and president of the Cyber Defense Agency. He says some estimate as much as 70% of the grid could suffer damage resulting from a cyber attack, which would render it unusable for as long as 6 months.
If that's correct, that's a strategically damaging attack on the United States. And the problem is that we don't fully understand exactly all the interdependencies within our grid and between our grid and other subsystems. So analysis really needs to be done to confirm that. And if that is true, we're way, way underinvesting in the defense of our power grid.
Sajjari was among the researchers and other experts at the U of I's Urbana campus yesterday for a workshop on securing the nation's power grid. For the latest newscast online, go to will.illinois.edu/news. This is the AM 580 News Daily Podcast. I'm Tom Rogers. Richard Ward found out he had an aggressive form of prostate cancer nearly 9 years ago. He was operated on by an internationally known doctor named William Catalona, who was working at Washington University in St. Louis. Ward was grateful, and he donated his tissue to his doctor for research to help find a cure someday. Later, Richard Ward was shocked to learn that his tissue was part of a tug-of-war between the doctor and the university. It's a case that's been to two federal courts so far. As part of our special DNA file series on genetics, Illinois Public Radio's Lynette Calls reports on a case that will have a lot to say about who owns our DNA.
Catalona is a landmark case because at heart, it's about who owns and controls your biological information once you've donated it. Richard Ward.
To think that they're fighting over a copy of my DNA, which we now know is essentially my blueprint for my body, I'm not too happy about that, frankly. I think that the responsibility should be definitely to do what I want done with those tissues.
Ward believes Dr. Catalona should have the right to keep his sample for research. After all, that's who he gave his tissue to. But when Catalona got a new job at Northwestern University and left and tried to take Ward's tissue and others with him, Washington University sued. The university claimed it owned the tissues, not Catalona, not Ward. A federal court and an appellate court agreed with the university.
It makes a mockery of the informed consent document.
That's Dr. Catalona.
You know, I think that this makes the research participants wonder whether that document is worth the paper that it's written on.
The appeals court said once you've donated tissues, you've lost control over them, although you can stop participating in research.
What we've encountered now is a giant bait and switch.
Chicago Kent Law Professor Lori Andrews believes the ruling sets a dangerous precedent that could let universities and research tissue banks use genetic material any way they want. She says if you donated a sample for prostate cancer research, it could end up being used for something else, like schizophrenia, without your knowledge.
Since these samples are so valuable and can be sold off to biotech companies, patients have begun to be viewed as treasure troves by researchers.
On the other side of this story is Washington University. It spent hundreds of thousands of dollars helping to create one of the world's most renowned collections of prostate cancer tissue. Dr. Larry Shapiro is dean of the School of Medicine.
This is not about profit. These repositories are really a valuable resource for scientists around the country.
The university has no intention of selling Ward's tissues, or anyone else's for that matter, says Shapiro. It's only going to do what Ward and others wanted, prostate cancer research. So here's why the university sued to keep the tissues.
If we thought that they could be disassembled at any point in time by an individual investigator, it would become very difficult to marshal the resources needed to establish and maintain these repositories.
It would cause chaos, he says, if patients or researchers could control DNA samples once they've been donated. Catalona says those fears are overblown.
Any inconvenience or problems it would cause are far outweighed by respecting the rights of individuals.
The Greenbergs would agree with that.
You can put those cherries out if you want.
Okay, I'll take out some tomatoes from the garden.
They're a suburban Homewood family who helped pioneer research for a rare and deadly disease, only to find it commercialized without their knowledge.
He did not have any head control, eye contact. He couldn't reach or grasp for toys. He couldn't put his hands to his mouth. He had a lot of difficulty eating. He cried almost all the time unless he was being held and moved.
Debbie Greenberg realized something was wrong with her firstborn child within days. Her son Jonathan had Canavan disease, or spongy degeneration of the brain. It's a terrible and rare genetic disease that disproportionately affects people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. If both parents carry the gene, there's a 25% chance their child will get the disease. At the time the Greenberg son was diagnosed in 1982, science had not yet found a way to tell if someone was a carrier. 2 years later, the Greenbergs had a daughter, Amy, and soon learned she had the condition too.
It was horrible to receive that diagnosis. And to know that you'd have to watch two children die.
Jonathan died at 11, Amy at 16.
They basically stayed at a newborn level their entire lives, except that they smiled and laughed, and every smile was worth $1 million.
Throughout the children's lives, Debbie's husband Dan had been raising money to help fund research for a cure. He even provided their children's tissue. He quietly started a registry of about 25 other families so there'd be additional genetic material. The Greenbergs were elated when researchers at Miami Children's Hospital discovered the Canavan gene and developed a genetic test.
If your children's lives could help accomplish something better in this world for other people, that's a real blessing that your children brought to this world.
But what happened next, they say, was like a slap in the face. Miami Children's had patented the gene, and the hospital had begun charging a royalty fee and limiting the number of licenses for researchers. To Dan Greenberg, that patent meant fewer people trying to find a cure.
I feel that the commercialization of the Canavan gene is really a desecration of all the good that came out of our children's lives.
The Greenbergs and others filed suit and later settled.
For the most part, medicine has become a big business, and it's no longer the altruistic helping of mankind that it used to be.
But nobody's making big bucks off the Canavan gene. Miami Children's invested more than $5 million into the research, and the small royalty fee it's charging goes directly back to research.
Profit can't be a dirty word, because if we don't have profit, no company's going to take the risk.
Patent lawyer Kevin Noonan, who specializes in biotech cases, says research is expensive, and a lot of drugs and tests never make it to market. So it's the promise of a lucrative patent that keeps the research going. Last year, the trade group called Bio reported the U.S. biotech industry made more than $55 billion. The industry invested nearly $23 billion on research and development. The need to advance medical research and fund it lies on one side of this issue. On the other, the need to protect the rights of individuals. Rex Chisholm, who heads the Center for Genetic Medicine at Northwestern, thinks his gene bank has a solution.
I don't like the idea that there are particular companies that might own particular genes in my genome. I think those are shared by all of humanity, and I think, in a sense, humanity should think about the fact that they should have ownership of that.
When someone wants to donate to the gene bank, he or she signs a consent form that is crystal clear. It guarantees the samples are used in a way that's consistent with what the donor wants, and that could include producing a marketable product. Any profits would fund future research.
I mean, after all, We can do all the research in the world that we want, but if we can't deploy that research to better people's health care, then we haven't really, I think, closed the deal that we made with our participants in our studies.
That's a deal that Richard Ward and the Greenbergs say is at least a step in the right direction. I'm Lynette Kalsnes.
Severe weather is a distinct possibility today across much of Illinois and Indiana. Our meteorologist Scott Althoff says today we'll have intervals of clouds and sunshine. It'll be very windy and mild with periods of showers and thunderstorms with some severe. Highs ranging from 72 in northwest Illinois to 84 in far southern Indiana. For tonight, cloudy in Illinois with lingering showers. In Indiana, cloudy with thunderstorms widespread early, then diminishing to the southeast overnight. And lows will range from around 60 in northwest Illinois to 68 in far southern Illinois. For tomorrow, cloudy, windy, and cooler. Widely scattered showers mainly in the north and east. And highs tomorrow ranging from 52 in far northwest Illinois to 74 in southeast Indiana. The high in Champaign-Urbana tomorrow near 65 degrees. Sunny and 72, the forecast for Saturday. This has been the AM 580 News Daily Podcast for Thursday, October 12th. You can find podcasts of Focus 580, The Afternoon Magazine, agricultural programming, and other helpful information on our website, will.illinois.edu. I'm Tom Rogers, AM 580 News.